were disappointed in what we were able to obtain. But after 4 days of federal mediation, even the federal mediator agreed that there was no way to move the state any further.
Contract agreements between the state and two public employee unions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 2nd of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, encouraging words from the federal government's gas pipeline coordinator.
Growth in electrical power, it really is the essential key, I think, to building up the demand to a point that Alaska Gas can find a place in there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. And by the Association of Alaska School Boards, parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org.
Alaska Governor Sean Parnell is among the governors who have received letters demanding they leave office or be removed. Parnell spokeswoman Sharon Lehow confirmed today that Parnell had received the letter in his Anchorage office on Wednesday. Lehow says the letter was handled by the governor's security detail, who passed it on to the FBI. The group Guardians of the Free Republics sent letters to at least 30 governors demanding they leave office or be removed. The Christian Science Monitor is reporting that the man at the center of the Guardians of the Free Republics is Texas talk show host Sam Kennedy. Although investigators didn't see threats of violence in the group's message, the FBI has warned that the group's call could provoke violence by others. Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell announced today he will not seek another term as Lieutenant Governor and is withdrawing from the August 24, 2010 Republican primary election. In a statement released this afternoon, Campbell said he had intended to retire from the Alaska National Guard at the end of 2010 before being appointed to the Lieutenant Governor position. He said he was honored to be in the role of Lieutenant Governor, but he has decided to pursue other opportunities. Campbell said he has requested the State Division of Elections withdraw his name as a candidate. Campbell was confirmed as Lieutenant Governor on August 10, 2009. The new federal coordinator for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline today told legislators that the White House wants to elevate the project for getting gas from the North Slope to North American markets, and the Obama administration is looking for ways to be involved. Larry Persily advised legislators not to take action to stop the project yet. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Larry Persily told lawmakers and a large crowd of staff members, lobbyists, and the public that the economic predictions on long-term market conditions, pricing, and costs for natural gas are all wrong, no matter what direction those predictions take. He says gas is part of any energy plan for the nation, and Alaska gas can be absorbed into the national supply.
Don't give up on a big project yet. A pipeline from the North Slope through Alaska, through Canada, tying into the grid that starts in Alberta that feeds gas across North America, from the Pacific Northwest to California, to upstate New York, to the Midwest, to the Southeast. That's the largest gas market in the world.
He said the response to the open season, when gas producers on the North Slope will bid on space in the line to transport gas, would determine whether the line will be built. That open season is set to begin in May. Persily was not supporting the state-licensed AGIA line or the BP ConocoPhillips line. And since he reports directly to the White House, he's looking for results, not labels. Persily addressed the market risks and arguments against the line, saying those elements must be shared and they are complex. For example, nationwide gas consumption actually fell in the U.S. last year.
Growth in electrical power, it really is the essential key, I think, to building up the demand to a point that Alaska gas can find a place in there.
The possibility of shale gas close to U.S. markets in very large quantities has been seen as a threat to the future of natural gas.
Shale gas is coming in many cases from new areas where there's not the infrastructure. There's, in the years ahead, they're going to need tens of billions of dollars worth of new pipe to move that shale gas to customers. So they also have their capital needs.
And the U.S. and markets in the Far East are already importing liquefied natural gas to the point that projections show an oversupply in another 5 years.
There are a lot of supply options in the Pacific at Tidewater that do not need an 800-mile pipeline through the Arctic to get their gas to a terminal.
Pursley says these are the conditions and the forecasts the market will have to respond to, and they must be considered, but not until the open season is complete.
That's the opportunity to gauge what is the market demand. Are shippers willing to commit? Are investors willing to sign more than $100 billion in binding contractual commitments to use the pipeline for 20 years or more? Certainly at some point, the state, the producers, the pipeline owner, even the federal government are going to have to sit down and talk.
Kodiak Republican Alan Osterman, the chairman of the House Fiscal Policy Subcommittee, remembers discussing the pipeline in 1995 when he was first elected.
I'm still of the same opinion that I was back then in having this discussion, particularly with the industry at the table, was that when the industry can see the profitability of natural gas flowing out of Alaska, we will have a pipeline. And that same thing that we're talking about today, really.
Pursley says there's nothing in Washington that's stopping the project, although there are steps that could be taken there to help it. He says the real issues are in Alaska, Texas, and Canada, and his job is to resolve them. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The state's two largest public employee unions have tentative agreements for new three-year contracts. The Alaska State Employees Association, representing 8,500 general government workers, and the Alaska Public Employees Association, representing 2,000 supervisors, both reached agreements yesterday. ASEA members have been offered a 1% pay increase in the first year of the contract and 2% in each of the remaining years. APEA members get 2% each year. There's one partial implementation of a geographic cost differential study, which takes into account the higher cost of living for state employees outside Anchorage. The state did agree to increase its contribution to employees' health insurance costs. ASEA business manager Jim Duncan says it's not what he was hoping for, but after both sides met with a federal mediator, it was clear the state wasn't going to budge.
We were disappointed in what we were able to obtain, but again, after 4 days of federal mediation, even the federal mediator agreed that there was no way to move the state any further, that they had a political position they were not going to move.
Duncan says that became even more evident after APEA reached its agreement. The state's Labor, Trades, and Crafts Union, Local 71, reached an agreement 2 weeks ago, leaving ASEA as the last union standing.
Once that happened, with the other two major unions already signing, the ballgame was over, more or less.
APEA business manager Bruce Ludwig is also disappointed in the state's offer to supervisors.
Well, we're in the final days of the legislature. The health insurance money, the costs have gone up $137 in the last year. Our members would have to pay that and be $137 a month pay cut. So given the alternatives, the team just chose to go with it.
While the unions aren't satisfied, Deputy Commissioner of Administration Kevin Brooks says the state is relieved to have the tentative agreements in place before the legislature convenes later this month.
There's always that tension with the unions where they would like to see more, and we want to try and hold down the cost of government, and I think we've reached a reasonable compromise.
Lawmakers have largely wrapped up work on the state operating budget, so Brooks says it's likely the contracts will be funded in the capital budget or a supplemental spending bill. Both agreements also have to be approved by the majority of the union's members. That process could take more than a month. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Bhutan refugees learn Alaska offers more than they'd expected.
And the refugee camps people, they have the concept that Alaska is a place where only snow falls and few people live.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The state Senate unanimously passed a new funding formula for rural school construction yesterday. Senate Bill 237 would require future legislatures to put $40 million annually into a fund to pay for new school construction. It's the first major step that the legislature has taken in 10 years since the Superior Court ruled the state's funding formula violated the rights of Alaska Native students. The legislation was crafted by the office of Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman. Hoffman and other legislators hope that the new formula will resolve the Casile case and provide regular funding for overcrowded school sites. The vote passed the Senate 19-0, with one senator absent from the vote. The legislation must now pass the House before it moves to the governor's desk. The State Department of Environmental Conservation will receive $2.25 million in federal revenue sharing to monitor water quality off northwest Alaska. The Minerals Management Service grant comes from its Coastal Impact Assessment Program. The money is federal royalty payments derived from companies drilling off coastal states. The grant will be used to expand the Alaska Monitoring and Assessment Program, now in South Central and Southeast Alaska waters, to part of the Chukchi Sea. The coastline from Point Hope to Point Barrow will be studied. Doug Dasher is an environmental engineer with DEC. He says the study will provide baseline information to gauge the effects of development and climate change over time. Dasher says samples from the water column and seafloor sediments will be examined for CO2 content, acidification, temperature, dissolved oxygen, and salinity.
We'll be looking at the type of organisms that live in the sediments to see what their health is, what the diversity of the population is. And then we'll also be doing two type of trawls, looking at fish that live near the bottom and also looking at fauna like starfish and that live right on the bottom.
Dasher says in years past, most of the coastal impact study money went to other states because there was less activity off Alaska's coast, but that's now changing.
For Alaska, it's developing a baseline of information on type of organisms, chemistry in the sediments, and in the water column. And the area we're looking in, of course, is not out in the actual lease sale area. This is in the corridor between the lease sale and the shoreline, where potential pipelines may come through, and of course there'll be a lot of activity in the future.
Dasher says previous studies in southeast and south central coastal waters are helping DEC develop guidelines for trace metals and sediments and making determinations about what is the natural background condition in places like Cook Inlet and Prince William Sound.
There are some areas that have ore bodies out into the marine environment that actually can have high chromium levels, much higher than you see in other locations. And that's actually just due to the fact that it's a natural ore body there.
An important aspect of studying the Chukchi Sea and other areas of Arctic waters is that currently these are areas not heavily impacted.
You can have atmospheric transport, but the levels are still low. But it gives us very good reference information for looking at, if you go back and now, if we have to look at harbors or areas that are impacted, it gives us a good idea of what that area should look like before the impact, as opposed to the work that takes place in the lower 48, these surveys where they're mainly trying to find an area that is, quote, somewhat pristine or a reference area.
Dasher says the information will be used by the development industry, government, and environmental organizations. It will also be used by the EPA for current and future national assessment reports for Congress. The Chukchi sampling will take place in August of this summer and another round of tests in the summer of 2011, with final reports out in 2013. The state's largest public employee union plans to file a grievance against the Department of Corrections for its decision to shut down three prisoner employment programs before determining what the closures would cost the state. Now the products and services will have to come from the private sector. Alaska State Employees Association business manager Jim Duncan says that's contracting out work that can be done by state employees.
Seems clear to me that this work is going to continue. It's just going to continue in the private sector instead of with state employees. So we're going to be filing a grievance that is a violation of our contract and proceeding through that process.
The Corrections Department on Wednesday closed two inmate work programs. A third is expected to end in September. Department officials say they're not sure what inmate training will replace the prisoner employment program or when a new program will be in place. From KTOO in Juneau, Rosemarie Alexander reports in this third story and third and final story in a series on the prison employment program.
Kathy Kokendorfer has worked with inmates for years as manager of the garment shop at Highland Mountain Correctional Center.
A lot of these women in the system come from dysfunctional families. There's domestic violence, substance abuse, and a lot of them come from abusive childhoods.
The Eagle River Women's Prison made prisoner uniforms, coats for Alaska Marine Highway chefs, stateroom linens, and even hats for one of Alaska's Junior Olympic Nordic teams.
Most women experience immediate self-satisfaction of a job well done because they can see what they have created with their own hands. They experience not only a job well done, but look what I have accomplished. I've seen this time and time again.
So Kokendorfer wasn't surprised that many of her seamstresses were angry and depressed when the sewing shop closed.
Our final week of trying to do an inventory was like a daily reminder I failed again for the inmates.
19 women worked in the sewing shop. At any given time, an average of 86 inmates had jobs through the prisoner employment program. Scott Willard is superintendent at Lemon Creek, a maximum security and pretrial facility in Juneau.
The whole point of the program is to give them a setting that would be more like a real job. They have to apply for it just like any job. They get interviewed, and the best interviewee gets the job.
Willard says wages ranged from less than a dollar to about $1.70 an hour, depending on the position.
Clock in, you clock out, you get evaluations, you get raises, different things like that to go with the job. Where a normal inmate job, it's a set thing, and that's the way it'll stay from beginning to end.
More than 3,700 men and women are incarcerated this week in Alaska. About a third have some sort of job. Corrections Department officials will decide how to replace the prisoner employment program. Director of Institutions Garland Armstrong leads that group. He says they're still batting around ideas. He lists vocational education such as building trades, veterinary technician training, dog grooming, and horticulture.
We haven't focused in on exactly what they'll be at every institution, but it's our intent to do that so that we have something in place when the PEP program comes to a close.
But two of the training programs have already ended.
Our intent is to still use that space for voc tech programs, and it's unfortunate the timing is not there where we can easily transition from the closure of PEP into voc tech, but certainly that's our intent to do that. Rather soon.
State law requires the prisoner employment program pay for itself through revenues with no state subsidy. In recent years, only the Lemon Creek Laundry has made a profit used to shore up the furniture and sewing divisions. Corrections Administrative Services Director Leslie Houston admits a lot of questions must be answered before determining new inmate job training and how to pay for it.
What we really have to do, and it's going to take a team of us to sit down, lay out what we want, what we can get funding for, possibly through grants, possibly with some of the services we will be providing, you know, to the communities and to nonprofits. There would be a minimal cost. We're just not there yet. We're still developing the plan.
Only the industrial laundry remains from a once busy complex of prison industries around the state. Corrections officials don't expect any new job training programs to be in place before midsummer. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Wasilla's Soil and Water Conservation District has been recognized for its leadership in education and outreach programs. The National Fish Habitat Board in Washington, D.C. will honor the Conservation Planning Group with an award later this month. The Wasilla District's program engaged more than 2,000 elementary and middle school children and adults in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough in fish habitat restoration and protection projects in 2009. The group worked with middle school students in 2006 to conduct stream studies on Little Susitna River, and in 2009, students worked to restore riverbanks. Frankie Barker is a borough environmental planner.
We are part of a national fish habitat action plan. In the MATSU, we have our MATSU Salmon Partnership, and we are one of, at this point, 17 partnerships in the country, and the award came from the organization that's our national umbrella.
Last year, elementary school students and their parents joined in a restoration project on Cottonwood Creek. They examined educational data collection stations and planted willows to restore the stream banks on both sides of the creek. Barker says the work is vital on two fronts: to preserve land that has been developed and to help young salmon find their way upstream.
We're doing some restoration of properties that may have impacted salmon. One of our big programs that Wasilla Soil and Water helps with is replacing culverts that block fish passage. And we'll be doing a lot of projects this summer, and that's where Wasilla Soil and Water comes in, because they often get kids out to work on the restoration of those areas. Once they dig up the roads and replace the culvert, then there's ground on either side that needs restoration and revegetation, because the juveniles need to be able to get up into some of the headwaters and the small streams that aren't as fast water.
Jean Hansen with the National Marine Fisheries Service submitted the nomination for the group. She said the small program yields big results. The Wasilla District was established in 1947 to help landowners in conservation planning and natural resource development. Last summer, a group of Bhutanese refugees arrived in Anchorage, ready to start a new life after nearly two decades in a Nepalese camp. Alaska has been good to them, but they're missing something essential. Michelle Terrio has the story.
Most Americans know Bhutan as a remote Himalayan kingdom that measures gross national happiness instead of gross national product. But for Amber Batari and other Bhutanese refugees in Alaska, the kingdom of happiness is the country they fled. Batari and his relatives are Lhotse Shampas. Ethnically Nepalese and Hindu, Lhotse Shampas have lived in Bhutan for hundreds of years. But in the 1980s, the Bhutanese government expelled them from the country, sometimes violently. He remembers it like yesterday.
Okay, I left my country, that was on the 14th of August, 1991. It was Wednesday morning at 7 a.m. I left. I closed the door of my house and I walked out towards the Indian border with my parents and brothers and sisters.
They lived in refugee camps in Nepal for 18 years.
In the camps, in the refugee camps, people, they have the concept that Alaska is a place where only snow falls and few people lives. And that was the same concept that we had before we came here.
Last summer, Bhutanese refugees began to arrive in Alaska, resettled there by the International Organization on Migration. There are now 67 Bhutanese in the state, with more arriving this month. Alaska has been good to them. Several have found jobs at Target, Home Depot, and in the Anchorage School District. Hari Subidi and some of his relatives live in a small Mountain View apartment, where we watched a DVD of a Bhutanese wedding. But the Bhutanese are worried about something. There is no Hindu priest who speaks their language in Alaska. In the lower 48, where most of the 25,000 Bhutanese refugees in America live, there are priests in major cities, or at least within driving distance. But not here. Batari says without a priest, important religious and cultural ceremonies can't happen.
That is, he's the only person through which we can reach to the God. That is the main thing that we believe in. That is, he's the person, he can reach us to the God.
3 months ago, one of the women gave birth. Usually a priest would oversee a naming ceremony for the baby, but with no priest around, the community improvised and called one in Texas. He tried to do the ceremony over the phone.
Somehow we happened to arrange a priest from Texas, but through telephone contact. He recited some holy sentences, holy words from Texas. So just for the satisfaction only we did so, but we feel it is still incomplete.
Having a priest to oversee births and marriages is important, but there's something that's much more frightening to the Bhutanese, the prospect of death without a Hindu priest present.
There is a due date for birth. We can manage for that, but there is no due date for death.
When a Lhot Shampa dies, their family must enter into a 13-day period of ritual mourning. A priest is needed immediately. If the mourning is not done properly, the person's soul is at risk.
His spirit will not rest in peace. That the soul will not go to the heaven according to our belief. It will go to the hell.
The spirit, called Atma, will haunt the living, they believe.
That Atma will just roam around and give trouble to the people. When the ritual activities is not done.
All of this, the idea that you might die in a faraway land without the help of a priest to guide your soul, is a terrifying prospect.
If I have to grade from 1 to 5 the scale, we are worried about 4.5.
They've sent emails to the Refugee Resettlement Agency, asking for a priest to be resettled in Alaska. They haven't heard anything yet. But despite the isolation, they're happy to be in Anchorage. It is a place so beautiful, they say, the gods must once have lived here. In Anchorage, I'm Michelle Terrio.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ellen Lockyer and Michelle Terrio in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.